Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Tyla Abercrombie, who is currently a guest artist at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company in Sarasota, Florida, appearing in You Can't Take It With You and Clybourne Park. Tyla's story is really interesting. Growing up in a family and a community where children were encouraged to have jobs, not careers, and with the idea of being in theater or being an actor was not promoted, Tyla somehow, to quote her, contrary, managed to become a writer and an actor and is making a life at both of these wonderful careers. Listen to how she did it. Stay tuned. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Show. The Lynn Show is all about being who you really are so that you can live the life you were meant to live. If you've been listening to the show, you know that as a psychotherapist, I believe that many of us, maybe most of us, are living out what I call our cover story. That is to say that we are demonstrating to the world and believing about ourselves a limited version of who we really are, and that we are keeping what I call undercover qualities of ourself, which for some good reason we had to first hide and then deny. I talk about this in the beginning of my shows and also tell you that you can get more information about this at my website, TheLynnShow.com. That's THELYNNE. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. TheLynnShow.com, where you can listen to other shows and hear what I say about this. You can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can also read an article I wrote called Psychotherapy on the Go, which is about getting psychotherapy on the telephone, which is the way I do it these days. And you can click on the email tab and write me an email, ask me a question, or talk to me about psychotherapy. I'm not going to talk anymore about becoming who you really are at the beginning of this show, because the other thing I do is interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and today's interview is no exception. Tyla Abercrombie is making her living as a writer and an actor, and her story is particularly compelling for me because it makes the point that even if the culture that you grew up in, the family that you grew up in, the school you went to is contrary to who you are, you can discover yourself, embrace yourself, become yourself. That is what Tyla did. And so I don't want to talk any more about that. I want to let Tyla tell you her story and also talk about the two shows that she's currently in. So here, Tyla Abercrombie. I'm here with Tyla Abercrombie. Tyla is here in, you can't take it with you.
Yes.
And Clybourne Park.
Correct.
Correct. Both of which I have seen. And if you didn't get to see her in either one of these, you need to run right down. She's remarkable.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And the range, because these are not the same kinds of women.
Correct.
Yeah.
Not.
So one might say they are polar opposites.
Is that right? This is true. No, it's very true. One
right.
can say what she feels, and the other has to just
sit on it.
Sit on it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. And what's kind of interesting, actually, about the character in Clybourne Park, in the first part of Clybourne Park, is she's having a little trouble sitting on it.
She is.
Right. But the woman in You Can't Take It With You. I mean, I don't know how you felt about it, but it seemed to me that she was comfortable with who she was.
Yes.
And not trying to be anybody else.
Correct.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the world that Peter Amster, the director, wanted to create, was that this, all of these people get to, and You Can't Take It With You, get to be themselves. There is no need to put on anything, any fake airs or pretend. Enjoy life.
Yes.
And so that play, being in 1939, is wonderful, because a character like that wouldn't be as free as Reba is in this household in 1939.
She gets to be herself.
She gets to be herself and
right.
say what she thinks and have her boyfriend come over because
right.
she's
right.
not married.
Right, right, right.
He stays over, so we know what's going on there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And just gets to be herself in
yeah.
this with this group of eclectic.
Yes, right. I might have had a different word. However, that is the joy of that play, the demonstration that people can be who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the face of a culture that doesn't understand it and has contempt for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, right? Yeah.
Well, and it invites that in the play, actually, because when the Kirbys show up, it's not that they necessarily have contempt for it, but it's not in their mindset to view a family or life from the same perspective as the Sycamores.
Yeah.
So they walk into a world that is so different than theirs that they could easily be, and do initially, or I should say, and are, initially very judgmental
yeah.
of these people. So it's a good representation of how we are when people are not like us.
This play is about appreciating, valuing, and loving what is best in us.
Right. I am constantly amazed at the houses that we get, because people love it.
Yeah.
They come out and see it and they have fun, and I've invited people who are coming back because I think it's something that you don't see in theater as much as you would like.
Yeah.
Where you literally get to sit and have fun and see the screwball family and yet be able to say, hey, that's my family. So you understand the daughter in it who wants to get married to this the Mr. Kirby, and he's so different, and she loves her family, and she doesn't want to not be with them, but she knows that they aren't what most people would think is okay, and so you have that tug of war that she has.
Not only that, but the whole question of being different than your family.
Right.
You know, and that, it seems to me, is getting more pronounced as the culture changes quicker and quicker underneath us, kids are more and more different than the families that raised them.
Right.
Because they live in a culture that is so vastly different than the culture that raised their parents.
Correct.
You know, so that just that whole thing, that whole question of, you know, if I am not like them, what does that mean? And what does that mean for me in terms of what you just said, holding on to my love for them and my relationship for them with them as I leave them, you know?
Yeah.
So, you think of this as a very light comedy, but I think it isn't really.
It really... That's what I mean. It's current. It puts issues in front of you that you deal with every day.
But it does it in such a lighthearted, lovely way that you're laughing while
you're thinking about it.
Right, right.
You know, and you're laughing while you see reflections of your own family in it. You know, and so that's what's delightful.
It is.
And very, it shows the skill of these two young writers when they wrote it, is that it can stand the test of time because it literally is saying, you know, as we change, we still love our family, and we're protective of our family. Like, we know that they're screwball, kind of funny, kind of odd, but it's okay.
Yeah, they're ours.
They're ours, and I want you to love them too, but I don't want you to judge them, you know, so it's very present. I think it's a very present.
I agree. I want to talk about Clybourne Park, but I want to ask you the question I ask everyone I interview, which I would have done at the beginning if we hadn't gotten off on this really interesting conversation.
Okay.
Okay, so the question I always ask is, I only interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
Quite clear that the art that you make your living and or your life with is acting and theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always curious about, when was the very first moment in your life that it occurred to you that being on stage, having people listen to you, acting, that you thought, ooh, I like that.
How do I do that?
Do you know?
Oh, God, I don't think I really do. I mean, I've traced that, you know, and tried to kind of clarify that for myself many times. I remember as a girl, being the Alvin Ailey Dance Company came to my grammar school to perform, and they did this beautiful piece to Wade in the Water with blue sheets that looked like the ocean, and it was fascinating. I didn't know that could happen, and not right before my eyes. I knew it could happen on TV, you know. And I think that was like the opening of the you know, maybe the first kind of watering of a seed that said, look, that's something interesting that I'm really drawn to. And later, when I was in middle school, I went to see a production of Sweeney Todd. And that was amazing to me because it had so much going on and it was an elaborate set. I don't remember where we went to see it, but it was like a school trip. And it was so, you know, so much going on stage and these people singing. And I just was floored by that, the ability to make a production like that. And what do you call that they're doing up there, you know? And I remember being amazed by that. And the only other thing that I connect to my interest in the arts is, as a girl, my mother worked late nights. She used to work as a DJ at a club, and then she worked as a bartender at another club.
Mm.
And she would get in late. And so I was always scared of the dark, and I would try to make my sister stay up with me, and they'd always tell me, I'm just resting my eyes, but they really would be sleeping. We live in a small apartment. And my mother would come home, because I would sit up and I'd watch TV until she got there. And she'd come in, and I would tell her about the classic movie I just watched, because I loved classic movies just on my own. And I would tell her, she wore this and she wore that and he did this. And my mother would say, oh, that's Barbara Stanwyck. Oh, that's Jane Cagney. That's Humphrey Bogart. Oh, that movie is all about Eva. That was, you know, whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that world that they were, you know, creating, you know. And so I think it was just kind of this combination of all these creative people or seeing these creative things that were so different from anything I'd ever seen before.
Yes, anything in your regular life. But also, there's the interaction with your mother around that?
I laugh about that now because she did it. She answered my questions with, you know, like she'd be undressing to get ready for bed or just kind of talking to me. It wasn't made to be like an event for us.
Right.
It was just what happened when she came home from work and I was still awake, which I shouldn't have been. But, you know, even to this day, I'm a night owl. I don't go to sleep to 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning. So it wasn't an event for us. It was just something we did. It mm-hmm. was I managed to not be afraid of the dark as long as I watched these old movies. Mm-hmm. And she managed to tell me who the people were because I could never remember their names.
Yeah, but what she didn't do was dismiss it or say that's silly or you shouldn't be doing that. Or, I mean, she didn't turn you off it.
Not at all. Yeah, she never had a negative opinion about it at all. I do remember, because I love to read. And when I was a kid, I would always read book. I read book after book after book. My favorite period, and still is, was the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm.
And I couldn't wait till I got old enough to go and be a part of the Harlem Renaissance. Because, you know, the Zora Neale Hurston's and the Langston Hughes and Allen Rock and Louis Armstrong and, you know, the musicians and the poets. And it just seemed like I want to be there.
Yeah.
So I was quite disappointed when I first got to New York and saw Harlem. I was like, what? I mean, and Harlem was nice and everything.
Yeah, I know,
but it wasn't Harlem. Right? It wasn't what I'd read about.
It was a number of years earlier, too, wasn't it? I mean... What you were reading about.
What I was reading about was the 20s.
The 20s, right. That's right.
The Harlem Renaissance was in the 20s,
right.
And everybody looked cool and fun, and the 20s were... You know, an exceptional period, mm-hmm. period. You know, it was amazing what was going on in the 20s. But for blacks in particular, in arts and culture, it was revolutionary what was happening.
Right.
And I was just drawn into that, those storytellings and those artists and musicians.
And the aliveness of it.
The aliveness of it. And
yeah.
I still to this day am not very, I don't keep up with, I keep up with current affairs because it's my life, but it's my life and time. But I am much more drawn to, you know, the stories of, you know, vintage or period pieces, you know. And I don't know why, I just always have been. And, you know, I listen to blues and jazz mostly, or, you know, folk music. I love older films. You know, my favorite love stories are never the ones that I saw on television that most people love. My favorite love story was Claudine. I always like movies with a little drama in it, you know, some kind of hard way to get to love. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. That's boring to me. I wanted to have some kind of levels to it. Or I tell friends, because I love the classic movies, it's got to have murder, mystery, and mayhem, and then I'm interested.
Yeah. So I do think that that we are drawn to what we're drawn to for really good reasons, but it doesn't matter what they are.
Right.
You know that.
And you might not, you usually don't discover it too much later. And you say, you know, people say to me, I sound older than I am, I have an old spirit. I mean, they've been saying that to me since I was a little kid. Oh, she got an old soul, you know, that's what our parents would say. And you don't know why that person is, but you just somehow are drawn into that world. And so I don't know, back to your original question, I can't say that I could put my finger on a moment
Okay, so then let's say all of these things combined in some magical way.
Mm-hmm.
When did you say to yourself, I want to do this? Do you know?
Well, I always wanted to be a writer. And that I do remember telling my sisters, and they humored me because I am a poet.
Uh-huh.
And so I would write poems all the time, and they would have to sit and listen to them. And, you know, they didn't have to, but in order to get me to go away, if they listened to a couple, they were free. So so I was always able to write and express myself through words. I became aware of wanting to express them through words on stage by being a poet, because I realized that I could take my thoughts off of a piece of paper and share them to an audience and have them go, I felt like you were talking about me, or wow, that was amazing, or even if they thought it was totally just my story, they would be moved by it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I did a poem about drug addiction, they'd say, you know, did you beat that or whatever? And I'd be like, I've never been on drugs in my life. But, you know, that I was convincing people.
Yes.
With what I was saying.
And you could feel the influence you were having on them.
Right, and I was like, wow, that's something to do. But I didn't think initially to write a play. I thought, I think I like writing. And so I kind of ventured into theater.
Was this in school?
When I ventured into theater?
Mm-hmm.
No, I ventured into theater, just community theater.
Uh-huh.
You know, seeing what's going on around the community. And it was in my high school. But because, you know, growing up the way we did, you know, poor family, theater was not something you thought about. It's something you did. I could have thought about it, but it didn't feel real.
Mm-hmm.
To think of doing it professionally. You know, when I graduated high school, I went to school and thought I'd study accounting. How ridiculous was that? I can barely, oh God, you know. Math. I was good in math, like, up to about 7th grade. Then I hit a wall, and that was it. And I never got over it. But, you know, I thought, okay, accounting, that'd be sure to make me some money.
Money.
And when I actually made the choice to say, you know what, I'm going to study theater, was when I was in school, and I was taking accounting at Roosevelt University, and I said, first of all, I was crying most of the time because I couldn't understand half of the damn spreadsheet. And I was like, I don't even want to do this. I don't even like it. And I said, if I got to pay for this education, I may as well do what I wanted to. And so I initially was going to enter the Roosevelt University Theater Program in Chicago. But I couldn't get on stage until my, like, second year or something. And that wasn't going to wash with me. I wanted to get on stage now. Mm-hmm. And so Columbia allowed you to be able to... Columbia College, start performing, you know, your first year. If you wanted to, it was up to you. At least I thought. And so I transferred from Roosevelt University to Columbia, and that's when I actively started pursuing theater and writing and saw it as a choice, a career choice. And now that I'm saying this, I'm actually remembering some odd thing that I heard where it was talking about what youths are told to do, which is they're told to find jobs, not careers.
Mm.
And I remember when I made the decision to pursue theater and writing, I said, I'm pursuing it as a career, not a job.
Right.
And I don't remember what that story was, but I do remember that being an influence on me seeing it really as a career. When I was younger, just contrary, I didn't want people pigeonholing me, and I always felt that way when I was in school, early school, not my grammar school, but by the time I got to high school, I felt that I entered a system that had already planned what I would be or wouldn't be, or what I could do or couldn't do, and that always frustrated me because I didn't have a voice for them. Like, even if I didn't want to do it, I didn't have a choice in the school system that I was being brought up in, and so I became what I feel like is just contrary. Like, I just was always in conflict with them. You know, if they said the sky was blue, I'd say, not really, it's more teal. You know, just whatever. And so that became, when I heard that phrasing of what inner city youths are
supposed to do,
they are led to find jobs and not careers. I said, well,
oh yeah,
I'm going to have a career.
Yeah.
And I would say that to my sisters and things like that. You have jobs. I'm going to have a career. You know, I was that kind of person. And so that's where it became for me. Like, I'm not going to just do this because I need to make money. I'm going to do this. This is my career. This is who I am.
And not only I'm not going to do this because I'm not, just to make money, but I'm not going to do this just because somebody said I should.
Exactly.
Yeah, I hear it.
So it became, you know, a battle that I was fighting that nobody knew I was fighting but me.
Well, but you were the only person who needed to know it.
Yeah, this is true. This is very true.
You know, because it was yours, right?
It was
yours. And clearly, it has worked terrifically for you.
Right.
So, okay, Columbia College. And you studied acting there and...
I did, and writing.
And writing?
Columbia was all right. Because growing up, I actually wanted to go away to school. I've always loved travel. And my sister reminded me not too long ago that I said when I was a kid, I'm going to be a truck driver. I want to see the world. Kids, right? See a world from a truck, the bed of a truck, whatever. Anyway, so I always wanted to travel, and I would say to them, I'm not sticking around here. I didn't, you know, I gave them my constitution early on. Mm-hmm. No kids, no husband, I'm traveling, not living in Chicago for the rest of my life, so don't even expect it from me. And just, you know, deciding, as you do when you're, like, young and you think you know what the future is going to be. And so I wanted to just get out of Chicago. I wanted to go away. I wanted to do a foreign exchange. But unfortunately, the thing that happens, I think, in a lot of black families, but definitely people who grow up in an environment where they don't have very much, there is a fear base that you get taught. It's not on purpose. No. You know, someone saying to you, you don't want to go work over there. You don't know anything about that. You don't want to go live over there. What if this happens? And so that's fear. So every time I would say I wanted to go someplace different, they would have something to say about the idea. You want to go to, you know, UCLA for what? You don't know anybody about California. So it would slowly eat away at that desire to get out of town and do something different. So I went to Columbia. My sister went to Columbia for journalism. So I thought, well, I'll go there. That's where she went. You know, nobody else. My aunt had went to college, but she was in Michigan, and so I didn't know about her university. My sister, my older sister, was the first one to go to college in my family, of my siblings, I should say. And so I was like, okay, I'll go there. That's how I ended up in Columbia. And their program was okay. But I don't think that it prepared me for being an actor. It let me play, and it let me examine the world of acting and trusting your fellow actors and ensemble members and being in improvisation and things like that. So it gave me some skills. But it didn't really prepare me. I feel I got that preparation by doing, by being in community theater, by going to see shows, sitting and observing professional actors working, listening to directors when they directed them to do and thinking, I wonder why he said do that. I wonder why she made that choice. Or being ahead of it, thinking, I would do this if it was me. And then the actor doing it and me being like, yeah. So, you know, so it was that process that I felt gave me insight on being an actor versus my education. I went to Columbia College and lived in Chicago and did theater there. Then when I did leave Chicago, I went to Los Angeles for 5 years. I lived out there.
So, how did you wind up out there?
I had written a one-woman show, and a friend of mine, who's a wonderful director, kept asking me, he kept saying, he'd read some of my stuff before, and he'd say, oh, you should write a play, and I'd be like, oh, I'm going to do it. And one day he came to me, he was doing a one-woman showcase.
Wow.
And he was picking several women to be featured in this showcase. And he said, you want to be one of the women. And an actor's teaching is say yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, yeah. I had an idea for a play. I hadn't really written anything. I had a lot of journal entries. So I put together this piece, and it went over very nicely. And he liked it enough to workshop it with me and tweak it and get it into a really nice position for a one-woman show. And then I had an offer in Pittsburgh to come and do it out there at a small theater. A friend of a friend who had a theater said, come do it out here. And from there, I went from Pittsburgh and did it. I did it in Detroit, and then I went out to Los Angeles and did it at the Coronet Theater. And I got to L.A., and I thought, I should stay. I'm going to stay. I'm staying. I stayed.
Finally. Right?
Finally. Mm-hmm. Not the way to move to Los Angeles, really. I don't think.
It's one of the ways to move to Los Angeles.
It's one of the ways. Like, I think Michael says sometimes when we're joking in rehearsal, he would say, it's a choice. It's not the right choice, but it's a choice. So that's one. That was one of those moments where I could have thought this through a little better. But growing up the way I did, I think any time I put too much thought in something, I would retreat. So,
well, I think given what you said about the fear base,
right,
that this was pretty much the only way you could have done it.
Right. It was the way I saw, like, if I'm going to do it, I'm staying.
Right. You were already there.
Right.
So you didn't have to make the choice to go.
Right.
But, right. Makes perfect sense.
Exactly.
It makes perfect sense. And so you said you worked in L.A., so that, mm-hmm, that worked out to be a good thing.
Well, it worked out. I don't know how good it was. Let me correct that. Because every experience is a good thing if you look at yourself, examine yourself, and learn from it.
I agree.
And own the things that happen. So it taught me about the business of acting. Mm. It really taught me the business and not the just the enjoyment of
it. The joy.
Yeah. And so it taught me that. And it also showed me that everybody is on a hustle. And that's not a bad thing. But everybody's is on their hustle. And in Chicago, we have such a nice little community of actors, and everybody works really hard. But you see people often, they're familiar faces. You can literally walk into the Equity office and be like, "Hey, Luther," and he's like, "How your mama doing?"
Yeah.
You know, because you know each other. There's a familiarity. And so you feel safe in that environment. Even if you're not working, even if you don't get the gig, you still don't feel exposed, like, "I'll never work again."
No.
Well, you shouldn't, but, you know, that's an actor's, like, torture to feel that way. But you, really, in truth, it will come around again. In L.A., the business is, even though I had a high-profile manager whose clients made millions, he still was not, say, Tom Cruise's manager. He was not, he had to hustle on his level.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
I do.
So he was constantly networking on his level. Now, granted, I couldn't even go to the places he could go.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But there were places he could be turned away from. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
I realized that.
I do.
And I thought, wow, everybody's doing it.
Yeah.
It's not just the actor or the actor in the position that I'm in. Every single person out here is trying to get to the next level.
Yeah.
And so that became rather exhausting.
Mm.
And even though I would work, you know, it was few and far between gigs. You know, you book a television show and you do, you know, 3 days on an episodic piece, and then you don't work for 3 months.
Yeah.
So you might have made $3,000 or $5,000 on that piece, but then you paid your manager, and if you have an agent and the government, and, you know,
yeah,
you got enough to pay rent and feed yourself for a couple of days, and then you're back to zero, you know. So I was working retail, this little overpriced clothing store on Sunset Boulevard where the women had extraordinary plastic surgery and, you know, were far too old to be wearing the clothes they were wearing, and they just wanted me to say, "Yes, you look great in that."
Mm-hmm.
And I just was like, this is retail hell. I'm in retail hell. And I haven't even paid for my education yet.
It's another hustle.
It's a hustle. Yeah, it's a hustle, and it's the job.
I know. It was the job. That's exactly right. It's the job.
And I was like, yeah, no, this isn't working for me. So, yeah, that became a place that I was like, because I got there in a certain way, I was always in this panic mode.
Mm-hmm.
Got to get a job, got to get a car, got to, you know, find a place to stay,
got to.
Everything, there was no relaxation.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I didn't have family out there, and the people that I do know, friends you said you had,
yeah,
when you left Chicago, become friends, you really did I know you at all in Chicago?
Right. Well, they're hustling. They can't afford it.
They,
you know?
Well, it's not even just that. It's not even just that they can't afford it. L.A. does something to people sometimes.
I used to say L.A. is the place where there's always somebody else on the beach.
Right.
So,
you know, that's a fun story. That's funny because I remember, and I used to laugh quite a bit in L.A. because the things people did. I remember walking down Sunset Boulevard. I was crossing the street. I was going to go have some Thai food with a friend of mine, and this guy walked up to me, and as I was crossing the street, and he was like, "Hello," and he was flirting with me, you know, and we're talking, and this is the time it takes to walk from one side of the street to the next. Now, keep that in mind. We get midway in the crosswalk, and this other woman comes across. She's a beautiful lady, and he literally turned, like, you know, he was talking to me, hey, how you doing, blah, 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 and then he turned, and I was like, did he really just do that? Like, did he just totally lose focus that quick?
Yeah.
With no shame.
No.
There was no, like, sorry, you know, done talking to you, deuces. He was just gone.
Right.
And I thought.
Yeah. It's L.A.
That is crazy. That's L.A. You know, there's always another person on the beach.
That's right. That's right.
I would always say it's the city of abundance and consumption. They want to consume as much as they possibly can of everything. Your soul, your spirit, the food, the clothes, the money, the car, everything. Abundance and consumption. That's all they want. Mm-hmm. Or not all, but that's how I
and
felt.
There are other things going on, but in the business, that's what it is.
Because I even said that to David Breitbart the other day. We were out rollerblading, and I said, because he lived in L.A. before as well, and I said, you know, whenever I had hung around my friends that were not in the business, I have a dear friend out there that's a pathologist, and her group of colleagues, it was very normal.
Yeah.
It was very like any other group of people. It was only when I was around other artists, and it was like, oh, God.
I have stories.
I know you do.
But I will tell you now.
I think everybody that goes to L.A. has the same story.
That's right.
I do. I swear. I can't tell you how many people I know went to L.A. A friend said they could stay with them. Got there. The friend was like, you can stay here 2 weeks. And then you're out looking for a place. You find a place with a weirdo. There's a roommate. You know, everybody kind of has this odd, you know, story that is like, yeah.
And then lots of us leave.
And then lots of us leave. And I would go back to L.A., but I would go back with writing, pushing my writing. And acting, of course, but I would really want to push that side of my work also.
So where are you living now?
I live in Chicago.
Oh, you went home.
I went back to Chicago. It wasn't my intent to go back to Chicago.
Of course not.
I went home because my sister, who's blind, had been laid off from her job of 20-some-odd years.
What's wrong with a job.
Yeah. And she had made, like, a management level. So when she was laid off and then told to reapply, her vision and all of that became an issue because she was used to delegating. She worked with the people she worked with for years, and everything kind of had been, you know, set up for that. And this new company now is saying, well, you have to reapply. So that turned her whole world upside down. And so I went home thinking, oh, I don't know what I'm going to do. What can I do? I'm the bohemian in the family.
Yeah, right.
Like, I haven't been responsible since, like, I don't know, birth. And so I was really intimidated by coming home to help. And I didn't know what do you do for someone that's blind and a mother who's, aging. And so I ended up being home for that period, and I came home because I'd written a book that was, you know, doing small book signings and things. And so it all worked out at the right time, and then I sublet my place in L.A., and that was like 3 months, and then that turned to 6 months, and then I got an offer for a theatrical production, so I took that. It was in the city, so that ended up being 8 months. Mm-hmm. And before you know it, a year was gone.
Yeah.
And I still had my sublet and my things in L.A., and I kept saying I was going to go back. And by the year and a half, I just said, forget it.
We get a lot of actors from Chicago here.
Mm-hmm.
They all talk about the sense of community that there is in the acting community, for theater people in Chicago,
mm-hmm.
and how important that is to them.
It is very important. Mm-hmm. I like it a lot. I think because if I relate back to that idea of the Harlem Renaissance, when mm-hmm. I saw or when I read about these people, they seemed to, because they could work in all types of joints. But they always had to, you know, go through a back door to stay in a hotel or whatever. So they would meet in their own community and do, you know.
Yeah.
And so, of course, my hope was to be able to be a part of jazz session, jam sessions, and, you know, things like that. And I feel like that in Chicago, and not because it's, you know, a segregated group, but that we're small enough that you feel like you can sit and talk theater with this small group of people, and you can go see musicians that are your theater friends, and when they're not on stage as actors, they plan a gig somewhere else, and visual artists that, okay, yeah, we did just do this play together, but I've got a small gallery showing at so-and-so. Right. And so you it has that little feeling of all these artists.
Yeah, it's a community.
Yeah.
And it's community. It's lovely.
I like that. And the fact that you can get to anything whenever you want to versus L.A. You got to drive everything. I was just talking about this today. I like the weather. I like being able to go from the mountains to the beach to the snow if I wanted to, which I never did. But knowing that I could, it's nice. And I like even on a bad day you come outside and you're like, oh.
Well, yeah, I got that here.
And that's what we were talking about, the person I was talking about today,
really?
with this afternoon. It's like, you guys have that.
You don't
have to, you know.
Oh, definitely.
On a bad day, you come outside, you're like,
in an hour, it'll be different. You know, even if it's raining, you know, it's not going to last.
Well, and even if it's raining, it's warm.
That's important to me. Me too.
Yeah, I can deal with the rain. Just
well, we'd be happy
warm.
To have you, Tyler.
Well, you know what? I do plan to come back. Let's just say that.
Well, so let's talk about Claiborne Park. They're going to do a reading of Raisin in the Sun.
Yes. Which is my favorite contemporary play, by the way.
It's wonderful.
I love it.
Oh, my God.
I should have mentioned that, too, when I said about Harlem Renaissance in theater.
Yeah.
That play was the first play I ever read and saw a play. And I don't see things like this is a play. I see it like a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the first play I ever read. And then to see the movie mm-hmm. was like, oh, my God, this is amazing. I think I should never play in Raising the Sun again because I always fall in love with my Walter Lee. Speaking of love, I know it. I know it's only because I really fall in love with Sidney Poitier. But so... like I'm connected to this character for somehow. I love Walter Lee.
That's lovely. Yeah. So I saw the West Coast Black Theatre Troupe production of Raisin in the Sun, and I thought it was wonderful.
Yes.
I thought they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. Right? So you want to talk about it?
Well, I do believe that a person doesn't have to see a Raisin in the Sun.
And
the difference about Raisin in the Sun for me is that there is a desperation in that play that is so... you breathe in their desperation, you know, from, you know, Walter Lee, the mother, Ruth, and Benita. You breathe in their desperation when you watch them. And so it's such a different play. Plus they're dealing... with the very beginning of the play, which the Langston Hughes poem points out, a dream deferred. What happens to that dream if it doesn't get to live? And so they're really at a very pressure situation. And with Claiborne Park, it was very skillful of Bruce Norris to take the Lindner character from A Raisin in the Sun and be inspired by A Raisin in the Sun to create Claiborne Park. Their issues to me are so drastically different. But it is a interesting approach at racism, economics, and a struggle of wanting to change but not being able to, or feeling like you can't change a situation. So,
you know, it's interesting. When you said that about desperation, I started to think about Claiborne Park, and it seems to me that they're all, certainly in the first act, they're all desperate.
Well, I definitely think that Russ and Bev are very desperate.
Mm-hmm.
I think Carl feels like it's a desperate situation. But I don't think there's any written desperation for Francine or Albert.
And that in itself is pretty remarkable, that where the desperation is in the first act. But for the and I don't remember the characters' names, I'm really
That's
sorry.
Okay.
But so the couple that are trying to get out of there, they are clearly desperate. And the guy who's trying to keep them from selling the house, David, the character
Barbara
David plays,
is clearly desperate.
He is clearly desperate.
Right. Their desperation, it's true that they are desperate, but it's a different type of desperation, I guess is what I'm saying. Different type of desperation from A Raisin in the Sun, where everybody in that play is desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And we meet them at a very desperate time in their life.
It's true.
Even Bobo, who comes in and gets this money and makes a bad investment with this guy, Leroy, and the money gets lost. Even Bobo, that small character, was desperate because he wanted to make an investment too, and you know, and loses the money. So everyone in that play is extremely desperate. Whereas in Clybourne Park, Bev and Russ and Carl are extremely desperate for, and Bev and Russ, and I love that, when I first saw Clybourne Park in Chicago at the Steppenwolf Theater, I love those two characters. I mean, I loved that I felt so much for those two characters, and that's how I like to be moved in a play, where I am, you know, I sit there wanting somebody to win. I want them to...
You're rooting for them.
You're rooting for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was rooting for them, so they are in this horrible place of not dealing with, and this is what Bruce Norris does, not dealing with many topics in that first act.
That's right.
You don't deal with suicide. You don't want to talk about the depression. You don't want to deal with the, you know, rejection from the community, the race issue. You know, Carl brings up the topic of what we are different, how we're different, but he brings up, they're all brought up on a superficial level.
Right.
So we don't really talk about what needs to be talked about. And that's what I think is brilliant about Bruce Norris's play. Raising the Sun talks very much and openly about what we need to talk about.
Right.
Bruce Norris shows us that we don't do that. We cover it up with all these things that are not important, and the things that are important just stay this backdrop, really fueling everything we do, but we don't discuss it.
Right, and causing all of this pain.
Wreaking all the havoc that dealing with,
that's
and if we just kind of dealt with it, we may move forward, but at least we could grow emotionally if we dealt with it, but we don't. And so thus Bev and Russ don't seem to, they have some growth because they at least do discuss it. But I always feel like, because my heart is torn apart at the end with Russ and Bev, played by Annabelle Armour and
Doug.
Because when he's saying to her, you know, trying to lighten the situation about moving, and she says, well, what do I do?
Right.
You know, it's like we haven't really talked about anything.
Right. You didn't, and you didn't ask me that I wanted to do
this. You didn't ask me, and as she examines, I feel like as she's examining for herself, what do I do from here?
Right.
Because we still haven't talked about our son's death, really, and we're moving, but we know why we're moving, but we haven't talked about why we're moving, and you still have your job, but you're not dealing with your depression, you're just going to go back to work. And we're still together, but we're still
apart.
And so what do I do?
Right.
And I think that breaks my heart, that there is no resolve there. It breaks my heart, and it's supposed to, which is why I say it's a brilliant work by Bruce Norris, is because that is how we lead
our lives.
Real.
It's quite real. Right.
And even with Francine and Albert, when they depart, with what I feel when Francine is saying, I'm done with these people, I'm out of here, it's no resolve. It's like, where is she going? What do they do next?
Well, and forgive me if I got this wrong, but there is a certain conflict between the two of them about what's appropriate, what they should do, what they shouldn't do. I mean, that whole argument about how he's going to help him with the box, he's not going to, don't help him with the box, it's time to go. No, I'm not going, I'm going to keep, you know what I mean?
Well, their conflict, I think the initial conflict about the box is just a matter of, I have worked for these people on a Saturday all day. I don't want to work here, but you don't work here.
Right.
Let us maintain some pride in ourselves. Yeah. You are not an employee here. Yeah. I am an employee here. And her approach at getting you to move this box isn't even respectful enough to just ask you to move the box. It's an indirect passive-aggressive approach.
Right.
And so I feel like my character is just like, no, let's go.
Yeah.
The end argument when she's saying to him, what the hell do you think you're doing? And he's saying, well, why are you talking to me like that? It shows where he's grounded and where she's grounded. He's saying, I'm just trying to help, basically.
Right, right.
And she's saying, you can't help this situation. You can't be the peacemaker in this situation because it's over our heads. It's not in our hands.
So
you show up and you think you're going to save the day? Not to mention, the person you should be focused on is me. And I want to get out of here.
Right.
You know? And so I think that ends up being their conflict. And it's disappointing because, not because he doesn't hear me, but because I have experienced all of this with them as well.
Right.
I saw the son dead. I had a relationship with the son.
Right.
They both acknowledged that I had some type of relationship with the son. And so this is not good for me either. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's been a hard 2 years for all of them.
Yeah. The other thing that's kind of interesting about the play is the relationships between the men and the women are almost all adversarial.
Well, and they can't help but be when each male, when that dynamic, that whole time period, 1959, you have women barely had voices.
Right.
Men ran everything. And the only way you communicated was through this conflict or quiet.
Right.
You know, so it was only two ways to express yourself.
Right. You blew up or you shut down.
You blew up or you shut up.
Right. Right.
And so it's understandable that there's this level of conflict that exists. And one time at a talk back, Brian Hirsch made a great observation that although Carl does all the talking, he can't hear what's being said. And though his wife
is deaf,
she represents probably the only person there that could hear, could feel.
Yeah.
She may not hear, but she could feel. She feels the tension in the room getting there. She feels the confusion happening. She doesn't
know what's
being said.
She's the one who says, come on. You know.
Yeah, she doesn't know what's being said, but she can feel the weight of the room.
Mm-hmm.
But we're also caught up in our voices. Not we, because Francine and Albert don't get to say anything, but we're so caught up in our voices, we can't hear each other, you know, or see each other, really.
Okay, so I hope that you are, I say this to the audience, I hope that you are titillated here, interested, because even if you just came to see Tyler, you would be glad you came.
They're
wonderful performances, Tyler. They just are.
Well, thank you. But I am very, very honored, one, I have to say, to be here at the Oslo because they've made me feel like I've been working here as a family member forever. I feel that comfortable here. Rather, they feel that comfortable with me or not is their problem. But no, I feel really good being in the space.
Mm-hmm.
And every actor on that stage, be them a student or one of the company members or fellow Chicagoan, it's a fantastic ensemble to be with.
And
it really makes each one of us better.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
And
that's what you always hope for as an artist, that I am on stage with someone that makes me better. Because that's how the ensemble looks great. Because I'm making you look good and she's making him look good and we making them good. You know, everybody's like, well, goodness gracious, if I'm going to stand next to you, then I don't mind so much. I'll just stand here and shut up. So it's such a wonderful ensemble, and I would say that if you can come and see the ensemble, and because we haven't talked about it, and really get the surprise of Act 2 in Claiborne Park.
Oh, yes, I'm not going to say.
Yeah,
I'm not going to say.
It's a wonderful surprise.
And I completely, well, for me, I was completely, I didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
Right, so.
And that's always the delight.
That's right.
And this is the other thing I'd have to say about, you can't take it with you in Claiborne Park, because You Can't Take It With You has nothing but fantastic actors all through it, a much larger ensemble, but they're both comedies, and that's the thing that people should know when they're coming to see both of them. They literally are both comedy. One more screwball and one more dark, but still, they are meant to deal with issues, but make you laugh.
Mm-hmm. And they do.
And in making you laugh out loud at these issues, think about what you've experienced. That's what they're designed to do. And I think both plays do that wonderfully.
I do, too, and I think that's a great place to stop.
Wonderful.
Thank you so much, Darla.
Thank you.
It was wonderful.
And I hope that you heard that it is possible to discover your real self, even if everything in your childhood mitigated against you recognizing it. That your real self is still there. Even if your childhood made you think that you had to be someone else or made you feel shy or embarrassed about who you are. And it doesn't just have to be that you discover an artist inside of you or some kind of creative person. This is equally true about characteristics like assertiveness, happiness, silliness, responsibility, independence. All of these qualities can be squelched in one way or another in childhood and rediscovered. And it doesn't matter how long you have to wait to rediscover them, because the rediscovery is worth it whenever you do it. So, unfortunately, I don't have much more time to talk about how this gets done. So I want to say, as I always do, a big thank you and gratitude to Josh Hackney, my IT guru guy, telling you, of course, that if you need anything to have anything to do with technology, you want Josh, and you can get him like you can get me on my website, thelinshow.com. And also to say, as I always do, that I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that reminded you about yourself, something that intrigued you, just some information you didn't know that you do now, something that'll bring you back. Because I will be here next week, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray, oh, you see my face and figure, I've both seen days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. See that I have had my shot, my time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get, I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flag, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune.